Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. Coming up, a close confidant of Kwame Ture blasts Peniel Joseph's book on the late black freedom movement activist. The people of Detroit get a chance to object to the plans of their emergency financial dictator. And is there any substance to President Obama's Young Black Male initiative? But first, California Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein used to be among the CIA's best friends on Capitol Hill. But that was before the spy agency got caught stealing documents from Feinstein's own Senate Intelligence Committee, which is debating whether to make public its report on CIA torture and detention programs. We spoke with Shahid Buttar of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. He says Feinstein's change of heart on the CIA is quite significant.
As the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, she has largely been complicit in the National Security Agency's or the wiretapping scheme, and she certainly was read into the Central Intelligence Agency's torture program under the Bush administration, but to no visible public effect has she particularly challenged either of those programs. So the fact that she went to the mat with a speech on the Senate floor described by Senator Leahy from Vermont, the chair of the Judiciary Committee, as the most significant speech he had seen in his 40 years in the Senate, was really quite remarkable. And it suggests that the criticism of the national security state has reached such a fever pitch that even its entrenched allies in Congress are starting to peel off and discover the critical voices that, quite frankly, they should have had a long time ago.
Well, does a speech like that from someone like Feinstein mean a sea change might be coming?
One hopes. It really is too early to say just yet. It could have been had the president taken advantage of the political space to do the right thing and walk his own talk. But as he has a habit of doing, his rhetorical principles about human rights or transparency, his concern for his legacy, he's even said specifically that he favors the release of the Senate Intelligence Committee report on torture that's at the center of this controversy. But even, you know, despite claiming transparency at every opportunity, despite championing human rights rhetorically, despite saying that he wants to see this report see the light of day and be released to the public, he's not lifted a finger to defend any of those values. And in fact, after Senator Feinstein crossed the CIA in front of the Senate, while the president had the political opportunity to jump behind her and say, yes, I'm with the member of my party who leads the congressional committee assigned with oversight to these agencies, he deferred to the agencies and said that he's not going to get involved. And it's an amazing reflection of how far we've fallen, say, for instance, since 2008, when the expectations for this administration were so high. It particularly strikes me as an especially bold contrast with President Truman's motto, the buck stops here, and the president is trying very much to pass the buck. So whether it's a transformative moment, given that the president has abdicated the opportunity to make it so, I think it really is up to us, we the people, and how much noise we can make to force the institutional actors to grapple with these issues.
How would you, in legal terms, describe what the CIA did in tampering with materials in the hands of the Senate committee?
The CIA essentially attempted to curtail and hamstring the oversight that the Senate Intelligence Committee is charged with performing over it. It's hard to come up with legal terms, quite frankly, because the legal arena doesn't actually have terms to reflect the corruption apparent in this exercise. This is an agency that first committed human rights abuses under the Bush administration, then destroyed evidence of those abuses to hide its criminal trail. Now, years later, having finally been investigated by Congress, it's actually going through the even worse exercise of not only spying on the committee, but stealing documents that the committee discovered. And it really compounds corruption on top of human rights abuses and executive secrecy and lawlessness. There is no legal term for that except for lawlessness. Maybe that's it. Lawlessness and corruption, I'd say, are probably the two best terms to describe the CIA's behavior in this episode. And the one thing I would say is that to this point, the agency has continued to get away with it. And until the report sees the light of day and the agency has to answer for its human rights abuses far beyond what the public has known about, until that point, it will still be, unfortunately, the CIA's game to contrive. They remain very much in control of its own fate. And while Senator Feinstein has done the right thing to finally challenge the agency, it really is up to the other members of her committee whether to release the report, and then it's up to we, the people, and the rest of the world to decide what to do with that information. And I hope very much to see some people prosecuted for their severe crimes against not only humanity, not only the Constitution, but it's worth remembering torture was responsible for the deaths of U.S. service members, and that's been confirmed by multiple people in the military and outside it, and no one has ever answered for those crimes.
So although technically what the CIA did may not meet the bar of obstruction of justice, the crimes including in the report certainly are felonies.
Oh yeah, they're worse than felonies. I mean, these are the kind of crimes that we went to a world war over 60 years ago. Right? The Nuremberg precedent established, among other things, for instance, the principle that if you commit human rights abuses, you can't say you were just following orders. That was the defense at the Nuremberg prosecution that the Nazis mounted against the Allies' prosecution, led by a former Supreme Court Justice, Robert Jackson. And the legal principle that World War II established was that human rights abuses are human rights abuses, period. There is no justification, whether you were taking orders, whether you thought there was an emergency, whether there was some national security justification. None of that is a defense, which is to say the CIA has gotten away for the better part of a decade with crimes way worse than obstruction of justice. It's obstruction of justice if there's a criminal investigation and you destroy the evidence. And what they did was destroy the evidence before the criminal investigations ever started. So that was the obstruction of justice. Now we're so far past that point. This is criminality that the law does not have words for. There are no charges to capture abuses of the public trust this flagrant and this wanton. The only word I can come up with is authoritarian. This is an agency deciding for itself that it stands above the law, and also deciding that it stands above Congress. And neither of those propositions can possibly be true in a country that claims to lead the free world.
And still pursuing the legal angle, President Obama's failure to take the CIA to task for these crimes does not constitute a pardon.
It does not. It's tricky here because it's not just the case that the CIA is acting criminally, and this is politically incendiary, but legally actually true. The Obama administration is violating international human rights law every day that they don't prosecute the people complicit in torture. And that's not just true since Senator Feinstein's speech in the Senate. That's been true since the first day he took office. This administration is 6 years into sustained human rights abuses. We signed an international treaty and enacted a domestic statute which require our federal government to investigate all credible allegations of torture. And that's never happened. And the fact of the president's decision to look forward, not back, is itself a violation of the law. Usually prosecutors have the discretion about whether or not to prosecute a particular crime. That's not true with torture. It is very different than other crimes in that respect. And it reflects the international community's agreement that violations of these basic fundamental human rights are worse than other crimes. And unfortunately, it's not just the CIA's torture or the CIA's obstruction of justice or the CIA's middle finger to Congress. Basically, it's also the Obama administration's abdication of its obligations under international human rights law. And these are principles that our nation was once very proud to have pioneered, and they're principles that the president is very inclined to mouth in public. But when it comes time for the rhetoric to become reality, unfortunately, the president to this point remains nowhere to be seen.
And in that context, the president's defense of the CIA is actually a defense of himself.
I think that's right, and by extension, it's a defense of the Bush administration. And don't forget that the Obama campaign in 2008 promised to reverse the Bush legacy, restore checks and balances on executive power. These were central elements of his campaign platform, and he's not only failing to do those things, but by defending the CIA, what he's actually doing is ensuring that the next president or vice president or whomever will have the opportunity to use torture as a legitimate policy choice. It's one thing to torture people, and obviously that's bad, and that's the Bush administration's fault. But to say that it's okay and there will be no consequences for it, that's the Obama administration's fault. And I dare say that that's a worse crime than the torture in the first place, because the most you could fault the Bush administration for is the torture that the CIA committed during its term in office. The Obama administration's precedent, however, welcomes torture in the future. And I think that is a worse crime. One way to conceptualize this is that 60 years after having won World War II, the Obama administration basically lost the principles that our nation won there. And I think that's very disturbing. And it's not unlike the parallel phenomenon with the national security agencies tapping the internet and the back end of the phone system. That's basically us losing the Cold War 20 years after we thought we won that. So we seem to be in this habit of resigning principles that we achieved and secured at enormous cost. And I do certainly fear where that leads.
President Obama made that decision not to take the CIA to task before the revelations from Edward Snowden and other revelations. Do you think the mood of the nation has changed and has become less tolerant of dirty tricks in dark places?
I think it absolutely has, and I think the Snowden revelations of the NSA's Dragnet domestic spying operations really did change the equation. And I think that's one reason why Senator Feinstein chose to finally start doing her job, is because she's hearing it from her constituents. In fact, we have an online petition at shameonfeinstein.org at which thousands of Californians have raised their voice calling for her to step down as chair of the Intel Committee to let another senator willing to do the job step into her place. And I think that that's just a microcosm. The fact that the authors of the Patriot Act have introduced legislation to essentially curtail their signature legislative achievement in light of the way that it was abused by the NSA and the FBI and other federal agencies, I think that's also very indicative of the sea change that's happened in the last year. And I hope very much to see that that attention and concern about privacy and checks and balances also goes back to constrain not only the NSA's ongoing assault on the American people, but also, for instance, the CIA's crimes against humanity. And there are other agencies, too, beyond the NSA and the CIA, like the FBI, like DHS, even the Postal Service is involved in spying on Americans, and none of those agencies have yet taken the same kind of heat that the NSA and now more recently the CIA have. But unfortunately, across the entire spectrum of policing and intelligence agencies, and in the case of the Postal Service, you know, not even a police or intelligence agency, there is a much deeper set of problems here. And I do hope, whether through Senator Feinstein's recent rediscovery of her job or the president's long overdue concern about these issues maybe finally emerging, or whether it's through electoral change at the ballot box, I do hope very much that across these different issues, we're able to restore the constitutional rights and principles that have long served our country so well.
That was Shahid Buttar of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee in Washington. Thousands of people in Detroit have mailed in their objections to the bankruptcy plan put forward by Kevin Orr, the state-appointed emergency financial manager. Reverend Bill Wiley Kellerman is pastor of Detroit's St. Peter's Episcopal Church and an activist with DREM, Detroiters Resisting Emergency Management. Reverend Wiley Kellerman says there's lots of passivity among preachers in Detroit.
While there's great joy and hope in those who are resisting, I confess to a kind of sadness myself, because it seems to me that the churches and the communities of faith here could be doing so much more to be resisting this thing. Churches are at the neighborhood level, and they see the consequences of the economic devastation that's happened, been forced upon our city in various ways, and they really ought to be on the forefront of organizing the resistance. They're natural communities of resistance, in my view, so we're calling on them to be concrete in acts of repentance, and we're looking toward Holy Week. That's when Jesus does a march into town and goes straight to the currency exchange, turns over the tables, and as a consequence of that is executed by the Roman Empire. It's an obvious opportunity to remember that story and to act in a similar way.
The currency exchange is a biblical metaphor for banks. Detroit is an 82% black city. It's overwhelmingly Democratic. One would expect that people are angry at the Republicans, but is there a general understanding that the banks are the nemesis?
Absolutely. The banks are the ones who have not only eaten out the city from below, especially with this last round of predatory loans to people who own their homes outright have been driven out of them, and we have empty and abandoned homes where banks are still making money. They make more money letting them burn than they do if they would turn them over and sell them to the neighborhood or give them to people who need housing. It's the same banks then who have done predatory loans to the city in the municipal credit swaps, Bank of America. They're eating out the city below from the base and extracting wealth from above as well.
And despite the fact that the city is absolutely cash poor, we see that it's granting or basically giving away valuable property downtown.
That's exactly right. Well, that's what this emergency management means, is that there's no democratic control of people in the city. In bankruptcy court, the judge says it's the city of Detroit's turn to speak. It's not the city, it's the emergency manager, it's the governor that they're referring to, Jones Day, the third largest law firm in the world that Kevin Orr was a partner in, and they'll make $100 million on the bankruptcy.
Democrats make a lot of noise about voting rights, certainly deservedly so, but what about the voting rights of not just the people of Detroit, who can't effectively elect anybody locally, but half the black population in Michigan is in the same boat as Detroit?
That's exactly right. Virtually every African-American city in the state is under non-elected governments, and three-quarters of the black elected officials in the state have been replaced by emergency managers. Plus, this is a law that people got the signatures to get on a referendum and repealed the emergency manager law, and the Republican legislature under Governor Snyder turned around in a lame duck session and repassed the legislation actually in a worse form. So that sort of thing in and of itself makes people say, well, what does it make any difference to vote? I mean, that's literally spiritually disempowering, as well as, you know, taking the vote away. There are both constitutional and voting rights arguments going on in federal court against emergency management, but I almost think of it as a spiritual assault on people's own power.
When you speak to your colleagues from out of town and tell them that the bell doesn't just toll for Detroit, it tolls for them as well, do they believe you?
Yeah, actually, I've been doing some writing, and I'm getting a very positive response to that. And an article that I did in the New York Catholic Worker, people are shocked to understand what emergency management means, and to understand that this is legislation that's coming out of the American Legislative Exchange that's really being tested here in Michigan. And they're testing it in black cities in order to establish all the precedents. People in Michigan seem to be allowing that to happen at this point. But once the precedents are established, this is coming to cities all over the country. Michigan is the Arizona of emergency management.
Very much as charter schools and other such schemes were first tried out in black cities.
That's exactly right. That's a whole other layer of the story here. The public schools have been under emergency management for years now, state control in one form or another, and emergency management most recently. We've had an educational separate statewide district imposed on the city, which is a kind of a free fire zone for for-profit charters and Teach for America, and the assault on black children and black youth and the assault on public education is just unbelievable and even hard to describe what's happening here.
Are people leaving Detroit in even greater numbers under these pressures or hunkering down?
That's a good question. I feel like people are hunkering down, but I don't know numbers on that. Of course, we had a huge loss in the last census, but that so much reflects the predatory loans and the taking of people's homes, extracting wealth at street level, taking their homes away from them. So that loss of population, as they assault the schools, the number of students is being drastically reduced in the system. And my guess is that some people are departing the city. And some would say that there's another layer of things here, is the creation of basically a white riverfront downtown Woodward Avenue spine, which is getting lots of resources and infrastructure, an abandonment of black and brown neighborhoods that will actually drive people of color out of the city. And I think that's a design.
Yes, the unwritten plan is that those areas wither and die.
Right, they pull the schools out of those neighborhoods, force students into these failing schools. They pull infrastructure and police and fire out of them to concentrate them in other areas. The assumption is that they want to refocus the population, but that means pulling the plug on neighborhoods where people own their own homes and are committed to living and building community. And it's true of the churches, too. I have to say the Catholic Church, which does kind of top-down church closings by order of the Archbishop, before they did the last round, he sat down with the mayor, essentially to find out where the neighborhoods that had a future and didn't were located. And so the churches are being pulled out of those neighborhoods as well. That happens in other denominations in other ways.
At the moment, you're gathering the petitions and filing objections to Kevin Orr's plan, but do you really think that that's going to stop this juggernaut? What's the next phase?
Detroiters Resisting and other groups have put together our own people's plan in response to that. That's something that some people are filing with their objections, is the people's plan for reorganizing the city. And there are elements of that which I think could represent some of the next steps of what we need to be doing. We need to stop paying these banks. That could be done right off the bat. Either Bank of America should be sued or even prosecuted. That's happened elsewhere. They should be returning money to the city of Detroit rather than making another deal to extract more. That's one front. You've just got to stop being in bondage to the banks. We need support for neighborhoods, and the city could do that. If the casino money, for example, wasn't going straight as a pass-through to the banks, that's resources. We've had money withheld by the state, revenue sharing funds that were promised and had been cut off. In so many ways, the cash flow crisis was created by the state and in order to declare emergency management. And if that kind of money were returned to the city, the obligations of the state, we'd have some resources as a city to work with.
Reverend Bill Wiley Kellerman of DREM, Detroiters Resisting Emergency Management. Historian and political activist Paul Street has been a critic of Barack Obama ever since he first declared for the presidency. In his last years in office, President Obama is pushing his My Brother's Keeper initiative for young black males, but Paul Street is not impressed.
It all kind of reminded me of my days at the Urban League and in around Foundation World. I don't see, you know, any call for what would seriously be required. This would be an out-and-out federal campaign against the war on drugs and the campaign of mass incarceration. I don't see any call for a Marshall Plan, a huge jobs program, a school funding program, you name it. There's so many unmet needs in the inner city neighborhoods in this country. I don't see any real call for any kind of significant commitment or resources to seriously tackle all those kinds of issues. I do see and hear a lot of talk from the president, from foundations. Kellogg Foundation is throwing a lot of money on this, about behavior, you know, about the need to make good choices, the need not to have, for teenage unwed mothers to not have children out of wedlock, to stay in school, to stay in these horribly underfunded, standardized, test-obsessed, frankly inadequate, persistently highly segregated schools, poverty-segregated, race-segregated, so far. It's any real call to fund schools adequately or create a job. So it sort of comes down to the kind of long-standing sort of conservative black bourgeois politics of respectability, you know, that were always trumped out there to great white approval by, you know, Booker T. Washington and then by the early Urban League in northern cities where the black bourgeoisie was trying to manage and handle the great migration of black former agricultural workers from the Deep South, you know, lectures on how to behave. So I don't see a lot new there. You know, you'll hear from Obama's supporters and maybe even from Obama's friends about, well, there's only so much we can do in this political climate. This political climate is shaped and has been for some time by white racism denial, by the reluctance and the refusal of whites to acknowledge any kind of racism, institutional racism, societal racism, as continuing barriers, which they very much are, very real barriers to black advancement and racial equality in this country. But Obama is the very example of his presidency, of his election to the White House, and the way he's comported himself and the way he's really stayed away substantively from race issues, issues of racial justice. And, you know, the significant extent to which he has engaged in this kind of attitude of lecturing poor blacks, working class blacks, you know, that the real problem is their behavior, not any societal force. So those kinds of things have fed and reinforced the very white racism that liberal political advisors, you know, and those types cite as a reason Obama can't really do anything on race. I don't think he really wants to do all that much on race. You know, he wants to stay away from that issue as much as he can. It's kind of unavoidable that he has to touch on it to some extent, in part because some of the pressure he's been getting from within the black community. But, you know, but when he tackles it, he makes sure to come at it in the most sort of narrow, bourgeois, Kellogg Foundation, Urban League-y type of way, with the primary emphasis on black responsibility, supposedly bad black cultures, you know, and supposedly bad black choices. And, you know, steering very far away from any of the really meaningful societal and institutional forces that continue to be the main factor behind disproportionate black poverty.
Yes, it's a very cheap, a very inexpensive sermon that just preaches the need for mentors and does not really address any of the material needs of young black men, much less their civil and human rights.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, the main thing people need in these jobs in economic development, they need a very significant major redirection of federal resources, you know, away from things like putting special forces in 120 different countries, which Obama has done, you know, and away from drone warfare, away from maintaining, you know, a military that pays for half of the war spending on this planet, you know, away from bailing out financial overlords that collapse the economy, you know, away from tax cuts for the, you know, for corporations and so forth. So it's all just a kind of way of pretending to be concerned about key members of your constituency without whom you never would have been elected into the White House in the first place, who you really don't care about all that much.
On the material side of the ledger, Obama, 6 years into his presidency, is now talking about reforming or enforcing regulations on overtime, and now he's boosting a $10.10 minimum wage. But this is deep into his presidency, almost the end.
Well, you know, it's safe to do all this kind of business because he knows half of these things that he claims to be for, which, you know, they really aren't very much anyway, can't be passed because he gets to blame Congress. He gets to blame the right-wing Congress and the right and the Republican Party, both of whom he empowered very significantly by being so centrist and so conservative and neoliberal from the very beginning of his presidency. But this is this whole line that we're getting now ever since his State of the Union address. You know, he's going to reboot his presidency by being an advocate of the have-nots. He can never specify black people or Latino people per se, but, you know, the have-nots of all colors in this great big year of action that he claims he's going to carry up. He's going to act wherever Congress and the Republicans won't let him, and so he can lift poor people into the middle class. And, you know, what this is about is just transparent. It's what Democratic presidents always do when, because they followed their corporate masters so loyally, they've lost popularity, right? And Obama's now down to 43% approval, 49% disapproval. And all of a sudden, start talking the whole line. You know, you're a man of the people, which is popular sounding. It's popular to talk about inequality and the have-nots because we live in a new Gilded Age, you know, where 1% of the population has as much total wealth as the bottom 50% of the population. And it's safe for him to talk about it without having to worry too much about upsetting, you know, the corporate overlords who fund the Democratic Party, because he can't really get anything done anyway. He sort of gets the best of both worlds. He gets to please certain parts of the population by sounding like he's on their side without pissing off the 1% too much because he can't do anything anyway. You know, it's $10 hour minimum wage. What would that amount to? If someone's working full-time, that'd be $20,000 a year, like 2,000 hours a year times $10. That's an attempt to co-opt the more substantive demand, you know, the fight for 15. Now, you're just about getting a little bit more serious in the modern American metropolitan area, $15. It's still too little. how about $15? How about $20 an hour? You know, where's this jobs program? You know, where's the green jobs program? The stuff that Van Jones was talking about. Where's single-payer health insurance, which would be the real solution for poor people and their medical care costs? You know, health care costs just continue to go through the roof under this so-called, quote-unquote, Affordable Act. I mean, what happened to the Employee Free Choice Act, which would re-legalize union organizing in this country, which Obama campaigned on in 2008 and just dropped immediately when he was in the White House? He's been chipping away at Social Security. What does that do to the have-nots? Where did any kind of call for getting rid of the cap on the payroll tax on Social Security so that we could really easily, adequately fund it? I mean, you just go on and on and on with what Obama's done and, you know, the lack of resources to really attack poverty because of the tax cuts that he's signed off and because of the war budgets that he's passed. You know, Obama says all this kind of business when he's talking at a community college or at a community center, maybe on a college campus or in a factory to union people. But then last fall, last November, Obama went in and spoke at the Wall Street Journal CEO Forum. This was in November of 2013, where sitting around with a bunch of people who really matter in Washington, the powers that be, you know, CEOs of America, he said, quote, "People call me a socialist sometimes, but no," Obama said, "you've got to meet some real socialists sometime." Whereupon the whole audience of CEOs just, you know, collapsed into laughter. And then Obama said, "I'm talking about lowering the corporate tax rate." He says, "My health care bill is based on the private marketplace. The stock market is looking great the last time I looked." More laughter followed from the CEO. See, this is this mealy-mouthed game the Democratic presidents and politicians always play. One disingenuous, false populist message to people who are suffering under capitalism, and then another message of reassurance and laughter and class brotherhood to the 1%, the ruling class.
Paul Street's new book is titled They Rule, The 1% Versus Democracy. Dr. Peniel Joseph is on the talk show circuit pushing his new book on black freedom activist Stokely Carmichael, who later became Kwame Ture, leader of the All African People's Revolutionary Party. Ture died in Guinea, West Africa, in 1998. Bob Brown was a close confidant of Ture. He has lots of problems with Peniel Joseph's book, Stokely, A Life.
First of all, I object to the forces with whom he is working with. His book publishing empire and network is part of, at best, a dubious set of characters whom I consider to be part of a continuing COINTELPRO and disinformation operation against Kwame Ture and our wing of the movement. And bottom line, I'm saying I have more problems with Henry Louis Gates and this arrangement than I do with Peniel himself. He is probably too young and too dumb to really understand, in my view, what he is doing and what he is saying.
What is Peniel Joseph's relationship to Henry Louis Gates?
Well, first of all, he's one of Gates' proteges, put in place and groomed over the last couple of decades by Ford Foundation, who, when the history is written properly, McGeorge Bundy and Ford Foundation are Kwame Ture and our wing of the movement, the revolutionary wing of the Black Power Movement's biggest civilian enemies. And his relationship to Ford Foundation, his relationship to Henry Louis Gates, makes him suspect. Gates cut a deal with a man named Frank Pearl, who everyone admits is a mystery, who he really is and what he is not. He's one of those characters who comes out of Chicago. He mysteriously winds up in Washington, D.C., Frank Pearl. He suddenly becomes one of the richest lawyers in Washington, D.C. By 96, he becomes a member of the $100,000 club in the Democratic Party, giving $100K to Al Gore's election campaign in 2000. He meets Skip Gates and by Skip's own words, he pitches for the 25th time the Encyclopedia Africana project, and Frank Pearl gives him $2 million to create that tragedy of history and encyclopedias. And then they morph into a publishing company called Black Civitas Books, which, according to the recent court documents they submitted, is an unincorporated imprint of Basic Books. This Basic Civitas Books, which published Peniel's work and Michael Eric Dyson and Cornel West and a who's who of African academia, is 90% owned by Basic Books and, quote, 10% owned by an individual. That individual is Henry Louis Gates. So anytime you have someone who denounces Kwame Ture and yet quietly, not secretly, quietly seeks to benefit and gain from Kwame Ture, that puts your question mark and, in my view, as at best a pimp.
Peniel Joseph is being touted as an outstanding up-and-coming black intellectual. What is it about this book on Kwame Ture that you object to?
The first maybe 12 or so chapters of the book are not as objectionable as the last couple of chapters, partly because Peniel, in the first instance, simply plagiarizes and regurgitates, for the most part, material from Ready for Revolution, which is Kwame's autobiography with Mike Fairwell. It's the same script. What Peniel does, which clearly shows he's not so intellectual, is that he merely regurgitates the script, and number one, he puts it in his own language and words. And his words, in many ways, are anti-ours. I mean, for example, he learned a bit from Manning Marable's mistake. He doesn't so much use the word reinvention. I might have counted three times. He uses the word hipster maybe one time that I've seen. We're now trying to digitize the book to get a more precise content analysis and count. So learning from Black Agenda and Jared Ball and Bruce Dixon and other people's criticisms of that form of critical analysis, he uses the word transformation. He likes these words like, you know, Kwame Ture slandered democracy. What the hell is that? He speaks about Kwame as a black rock star and a chocolate Fred Astaire. I mean, the only people who have any relevance to Fred Astaire would be 80-year-old white women who may have dreams of dancing with a chocolate Fred Astaire, or an 80-year-old white man. Even white youth today would not be turned on by any references to a Fred Astaire. He uses, I don't like the word neoliberal because I wouldn't want to insult neoliberalism with this. Let me use the word innocence, because he's extremely innocent and just being used, or he's extremely treacherous. But again, that is not that first part of the book, which most people never really get to reading the last part of it. It's not as objectionable because, again, he merely parrots it from the autobiography. And since autobiographies do not have footnotes and citations, what he does is that he uncritically throws into the soup some newspaper clippings and a few FBI documents and a few State Department documents. He claims he has 20,000 pages of Kwame's personal FBI file, which he got off my back, because I filed an FOIA request in January 1, 1999, with an authorized affidavit signed by Kwame Ture 2 or 3 days before he made his transition. But by the time the request went through its administrative processes, It was now 2004, 2005, and they asked me for 15 cents a page plus fees for 90,000 pages of Kwame's personal file, which wasn't even the complete file. So literally, I could not afford and would not pay that kind of money for 90,000 pages of Kwame's file. But after that, the Electronic Freedom Act enabled him to allegedly get 20,000 pages of Kwame's federal or headquarters file. Yet he, for whatever reason, at best only used 100 or 150 pages. We're trying to get that figure down precise and see exactly what he quoted and did not quote. He quotes it uncritically. And everybody knows that COINTELPRO and other similar operations like Operation Mockingbird, you know, racial matters. COINTELPRO was only one government intelligence program. Part of the one of the main objectives was to do a character assassination and to discredit and to destroy people's characters and whatnot. And yet when you regurgitate gossip, like Manny Marable did, unsubstantiated rumor and unsubstantiated gossip, which you get from FBI files. The brother who worked with Manning, who did the eulogy at Manning's funeral, said that Manning was a prodigious gossiper. Well, he was not as prodigious as J. Edgar Hoover. J. Edgar Hoover was the best gossiper the world has ever seen. And he would take gossip in order to discredit and to destroy movements and individuals and whatnot. So we have problems with this so-called genre of history, this psycho-history, psycho-drama, that all personal is political. We have very serious problems with that. We have problems when he told me that his publishers wanted him to put salacious gossip in the book on Kwame Ture, and I laughed and said, well, do you have any, son? And he says, oh, well, I have some personal information on Kwame Ture. And then what you do is you go into the SNCC files and you find two or three letters that you consider to be personal between Kwame and, you know, a couple of women, and which is Kwame's mistake for even commingling his personal communications with the SNCC files, and who the hell knows who owns the SNCC files tonight. But that's another intellectual copyright fight that's brewing under the same. But then you out so-called relationships. You name names of women who Kwame allegedly had at least communications with, and you have no communications with the women. If you view them to be victims of a relationship, then you have a responsibility not to further victimize them, not to mention their names without their permission. Now, he may have had one or two women's permission that he quotes in the text of the book, but he mentions other alleged relationships in the footnote of the book, and he allegedly mentions women's names. I mean, clearly it shows his disrespect for women. So it's this level of dishonesty with the first part of the book. He praises Kwame Ture for Kwame Ture's alleged relationship and role and contributions to the civil rights movement, to the fight for the right to vote, to the fight for the right to be a part of a Democratic Party, and to be a part of the so-called rising middle class, which Skip Gates proudly says he's a part of, and whatnot, this neo-colonial class within our community that, unfortunately, the negative aspects of affirmative action helped to create. These Barack Obamas, these Skip Gates, these Peniel Josephs, these jocks who are now, you know, diplomats and experts all around the world and whatnot. I mean, it just created this parasitic class within our community, which they are proud to be a part of, and they denounce Kwame for refusing to become a part of. because at every step in his career and his life, from the time he was 9 years old, when he was presented the opportunity to join that elite, that establishment, he said no. The headlines say that he said black power. He never said he coined black power. No one with any sense and logic ever said that, especially someone who was required to read Richard Wright's book on black power as part of English classes at Howard University, if not at Bronx High School. But in order to diminish and redefine his role, there's this sexist, pathological attempt to find out the origins of black power. I mean, for someone to run around today claiming to be the father of black power studies, and I raise it with Pinel, is pathological. Okay, if we got to find the father, who the hell is the mother? And if we are really honest with the so-called Afrocentric and all the new studies that have reclaimed African history, the mother of black power must be in Egypt or in Nubia, not in the United States. But then it turns. It's almost like a committee, a new team of people who've come in, and now they're doing the hatchet job. Kwame Ture called for black power and then left the country. He's being condemned for having left the country. Well, hell, they're not honest. W.B. Du Bois left the country and renounced U.S. citizenship, albeit he was forced to because of the McCarthy period and the threats at least to put him in jail. But can Skip Gates denounce W.B. Du Bois for having left the country and renounce U.S. citizenship? Hell no. And still claim to be chairman of the Du Bois Institute of Harvard University.
You've served papers on Peniel Joseph. You say that he taped you without your permission.
He said he taped me. He said he had a telephone interview with me in 2010, and it was audio taped. He says it. In his source and bibliography section of that book, I gave him no interview. I talked to him, yes. I've talked to you many times. It was not an interview. This is an official interview. So he says he did an interview and he taped me. I served papers on him accusing him of wiretapping, which is illegal under Massachusetts law, and he would face 7 years in the federal penitentiary if I went the criminal route. It, however, is legal to tape someone in D.C. or North Carolina, depending on where I was when that telephone conversation went down. Long story, we did a round in the courthouse. I asked for a temporary restraining order, restraining the publication, marketing, distribution, display, sale, book tours, everything. I just tossed the kitchen sink. I knew that I would not win the legal battle. His lawyers representing Skip Gates' company lied and said that there was no precedent for such a sweeping order. That's not true, because Malcolm X's estate did get such a sweeping order against Third World Press for the publication of the diary. The difference is that the diary was an intellectual property rights issue, a copyright issue. My issue was a privacy and wiretapping, so I lost that round legally. But politically, I gained what I wanted, a public official disassociation from that book, because he pimped me. He had no reason to mention my name in that book except to make it appear as if I endorsed and or agreed with some or all of that book. So I at least got the court record. The judge did not rule on that. But there is a transcript where in the dialogue of the judge and me, we kind of agreed, not to officially agree, but I don't have nothing to do with that book.
Bob Brown, a close friend and comrade of Kwame Ture, speaking from Washington.
The United States has been trying to overthrow the government in Venezuela at least since the early days of the Bush administration. It's the same story under Barack Obama. Mumia Abu-Jamal, America's best-known political prisoner, files this report for Prison Radio.
The United States has tried several times to stage a coup against Venezuela, especially during the outsized life of the late President Hugo Chavez. It was April 2002 when U.S.-backed corporate and military forces ousted Chavez and tried to install a puppet regime. Within days, the streets of Caracas came alive to bring back Chavez and restore him to the presidency. Here we go again. Right-wing and corporate-backed forces are now trying to spark popular revolts against the Bolivarian successor to Chavez, Nicolas Maduro. And guess who's backing them? Members of America's Millionaire Congress. Using right-wing claims of government attacks on peaceful protests and on a free press, members of the U.S. corporate Congress are trying to scare up sanctions against the socialist government of Venezuela. We saw no congressional action when peaceful protests were waged in cities across America. The Occupy movement, peacefully protesting corporate greed and the brutal tyranny of the 1%, got first slimed in the corporate press. And when the media turned out the lights, they got beaten by police, their tents and property seized and destroyed. Mayors across America conspired with Homeland Security to run their encampments off the streets. Some protesters were shot by cops and injured badly. From Congress came nothing but silence. Now the 10% Congress, at the behest of several anti-Castro Cubans, are attacking Venezuela's democracy, again on behalf of the 1%. This is nothing but another attempted coup with American money and backing. Their noses are so busy poking into others' business that it ignores the cancer at home, which may explain its now epic low levels of support, 10%.
Mumia Abu-Jamal speaking from Frackville State Prison in Pennsylvania. In 1975 and 1976, when the fate of the Black Liberation Movement in Southern Africa was very much in doubt, Cuba sent troops and weapons to freedom fighters in Angola. Dr. Piero Gliesas has written a book on that critical period titled Visions of Freedom, Havana, Washington, Pretoria, and the Struggle for Southern Africa. Dr. Gliesas is professor of American Foreign Policy at the School of Advanced International Relations at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. He was interviewed by Your World News host Solomon Komasan.
Fidel Castro understood a victory of South Africa and the United States in Angola would have meant to tighten the grip of apartheid over the people of Southern Africa. And for Fidel Castro, for the Cuban Revolution, the struggle against apartheid was what Fidel Castro called la causa más bonita de la humanidad, the most beautiful cause of mankind. Again, this may sound rhetorical, but keep in mind what Kissinger said. Fidel Castro was the most genuine revolutionary leader then in power. So this is the first great contribution of Cuba to the liberation of Southern Africa. It allowed in Angola the coming to power of the one honest progressive movement in Angola, the MPLA. And the movement that was winning the civil war before South Africa invaded. The Cuban victory had also an impact in the struggle in Namibia, where there was a liberation movement, SWAPO, fighting against South African rule. As General Haldane Ice, who was in the early 1980s the commander of the South African occupation troops in Angola, as written, the Cuban victory in Angola meant that SWAPO would finally acquire what is a vital element in a struggle of liberation, which is a rear base from which to operate. Now they could operate from Angola. And at the same time, the MPLA, which has always had a very strong internationalist policy, allowed the Cubans to train the guerrillas of the ANC of Nelson Mandela and the guerrillas of SWAPO in its territory in Angola. So all this is the impact of the first Cuban intervention in 1975-1976.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda Television. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.